the University Forum. I'm Gene Moore, bringing you conversations with outstanding personalities on issues of interest to local, national, and international communities. Our topic today, helping Katrina survivors in Arkansas, with my guest, Ms. Ann Todd, the Membership Services Manager for the WRTI Temple University Public Radio Network. Ms. Todd served as Applicant Services Specialist in the Individual Assistance Cadre, who provided 30 days of services as a Crisis Corps volunteer from October 26th to the November 23rd, 2005 date, locating and assisting hurricane evacuees who were staying in southwestern areas of the state of Arkansas. Welcome to University Forum, Ann Todd.
Thank you, Jean.
I'm delighted to have you, and I thank you for joining me on the program to share not only your experiences in Arkansas, but hopefully some of the other things that you've done, your fascinating background and things that you've been involved in. But tell me first, why did you volunteer to help people who were victims of Katrina?
Well, I just got moved thinking about it, how helpless we all felt to do something. First, I mean, there were a group of us here talking at WRTI as the flooding was happening, you know, what can we do, what can we do? And I said, well, one thing we could do is figure out what we can do now. I said, let's all go to our computers, and if it's make a contribution, do that. So I made a financial contribution. But about a month later, I got an email from the Peace Corps asking if any of us returned volunteers would be willing to take 30 days and assist with the hurricane relief. And I scanned my mind quickly, and I thought, I want to do this. You know, how can I do it? And I put in my application, and 24 hours later, I was interviewed, and I got a leave of absence and took all my vacation time and personal time. And then they said, okay, get on a plane 2 days from now. And we didn't know at that point whether we were going to be staying in New Orleans in tents. They said, take a, you know, a sleeping bag and don't plan to shower for an extended period of time. As it turned out, we did not. The group that I went with did not serve in New Orleans, but rather in Arkansas.
Did they give you some advanced training?
Yes. We were first flown from wherever we were in the country. There were a group of 24 of us returned Peace Corps volunteers, and they flew us from wherever our homes were down to Orlando, where the FEMA training center is. What happened was that Peace Corps apparently was approached by FEMA saying, we need assistance. They decided to ask return volunteers if we would be willing to take the 30 days. We already had a lot of security clearance having served in the Peace Corps. So they said, if you've been in the Peace Corps for a year or more in country and you're willing, we want you to help. So we were flown down to Orlando, and we had about 4 days of training with FEMA in disaster relief.
And you brought all of that Peace Corps experience with you. My goodness.
Well, Peace Corps experience really is taking people as they are, loving them, finding out what we can do to be of assistance, and just reaching out and assisting, helping.
Well, it wasn't a part of what you were doing down there just that, though. But it seems to me that it must have been very difficult to find people who are dislocated and have come through such horrible experiences. What was it like?
Yeah. Well, we were working out of a disaster relief center in Little Rock, Arkansas. And they divided us up into teams of two. We got a rental car, and my partner and I were sent down to Texarkana. And they said, your job is to find where the evacuees are. They were aware that there were evacuees staying in different hotels, and they wanted to locate them and make sure that they were registered for all the benefits that they could get, the housing assistance, medical assistance, and everything. So my partner and I got down there on a Saturday, and on Sunday morning, I started going from church to church and asking if I could address the congregation. And I introduced myself, said what my partner and I were there for, and said I'd be outside in case any of the people in the congregation either were evacuees or knew of them. And at one church, a woman approached me after the service and said that she taught in the school district and she knew particularly about a family that was there. So I called, and then I was connected in the Texarkana School District to the woman who was in charge of all the homeless children, and the evacuees were considered homeless at this point in their categorization in the school district. And we immediately set up a meeting with all the guidance counselors from all the schools in Texarkana, assembled a meeting of everyone the very next morning. They had never gotten together before, these guidance counselors. They all came with their lists of families, all the names, phone numbers, everything that we needed. And they said, take our conference room. We'll give you computers and phones, because we didn't have any of that. And we'll set up appointments for the families to come in and meet with you here. So it was just marvelous collaboration with the Texarkana School District.
Were most of the children with their parents, or were they separated from them?
Not in Texarkana, but in another location. We did, I think it was Pine Bluff, Arkansas. There was a young man who was 16 who had been separated from his family, and he didn't know where they were at this point. So the job was to try to connect him back up with his family.
What was the emotional condition of most of the people that you met then? Because this was back October to November, not that long after the event. What were they like?
I thought they were magnificent. They had been through so much. A lot of the people that I talked to had been not only in the Superdome, but then they were evacuated from the Superdome to the Astrodome in Houston. Then Rita came, and they were evacuated from the Astrodome and just put in buses. So they'd been through a whole lot, and they were still wonderful. As soon as they could tell that we were really there as their advocate to get on the phone with FEMA to deal with bureaucracy, that was really the cultural experience for a Peace Corps volunteer. The evacuees were wonderful, and the real experience was navigating the system. They have to fax their XYZ form, and, you know, well, they already did. So it was being the... that we really were supposed to be representing FEMA, but as Peace Corps volunteers, we used our creativity and our ingenuity to figure out how to best serve each family and each individual that we met.
Did you have the, or did you take, really, the latitude to do what you thought was best at that time, or did you feel somewhat encumbered because of the governmental interventions that sometimes occur?
I always take whatever latitude I need to take, what I feel compelled to do. So I did get in trouble with FEMA a lot. We made the mistake of walking across the street in Texarkana because one of the hotels listed was across the street in Texas. And when our paperwork was faxed up to Little Rock, they called us up and said, you know, shook the papers in front of me, what are you doing in Texas? I said, well, we walked across the street.
It's a border town, isn't it?
Yeah. And what else? Let's see, what else? I got in trouble because there was one family where there were a number of handicapped children, and they were totally self-sufficient, but they had adjoining rooms and a hotel, and they just wanted not to be set out on the street because we were there when they gave notice, like these people had to be out of the hotel rooms, they said, by November 30th. And I kind of put my heels in the ground, and I said, wait a minute, that's not what they were told. So I took photographs of this one family and sent them up to Little Rock and said, this mother and her sister and her daughter are taking care of these two handicapped children. They must stay together and they must be able to stay in their hotel room. So I got called up to Little Rock again. You're not a social worker. You're there representing FEMA.
But so, so social workers can't represent FEMA?
Well, I think... I was really advocating for the evacuees.
Of course you were. Of course you were. And one would have thought that that's what you should have been there to do. Given the problem was supposed to be there, the clients.
Right.
They didn't cause the problem. What kinds of reaction did you get from the relocatees concerning just how they were being shuffled, really, until you got there?
In one case, Clarence, my partner and I, went into a hotel and there were about 10 people. The person at the desk would call the rooms and all the people would come down to meet with us. And they were really angry because they had just gotten this notice that they had to be out of the hotel. And so we talked, we understood, we listened to them. And then, you know, we said, listen, we've got to be able to work with each one of you to figure out what you need. We're here to work with you. We didn't necessarily agree with the deadline, but we had to work with what we were told. And yet, I think pretty quickly when we'd meet with people, they realized that we were there to do whatever we could to be of assistance to them.
How did they feel about what was happening with the government, though? Or did they have a reaction that they felt free enough to sound off when they were angry? But why did they have to be out anyhow?
Why did they have to be out of the hotels?
Why did they have to be out?
My understanding was that Homeland Security dictated to FEMA. Probably somebody put some political pressure on Homeland Security about the amount of money that was being spent on hotel rooms. So Homeland Security squished FEMA, who said, okay, you know, we're told we have to do this. In one of the meetings that I was in, I actually said, it seems to me, given that this is not what's written up, they actually had written things that they could stay in the rooms for a longer period of time than they were then told. I said, well, this sounds like a class action suit could be filed. And in fact, that's what happened not too long later. But it was a privilege as a Peace Corps volunteer to be asked to serve, to be embraced by FEMA and Homeland Security as partners. So I want to make sure that I acknowledge that it was an incredible job for them to try to do. And there were lots and lots of people who were working, doing their absolute best to navigate what was, for them, unknown territory.
I was impressed by some of the things on your website that related to the background, how they were trying to find the people and some of the procedural steps that were in there. But also you can also sense, I've worked for government, and I know the sense of within all of that, rules are rules and manuals are manuals, and therein lies the problem quite often.
Well, the freedom that we had as Peace Corps volunteers was we knew that we were volunteering for 30 days. It's not as though by resisting some rule or working around it that we were going to lose our jobs. So we did our best. Well, there's a phrase in FEMA, be FEMA flexible. We flexed as best we could, but basically focused on the needs of the evacuees.
That's kind of interesting. FEMA flexible, not just be flexible, because in a sense, you're there hopefully to respond to a very horrible experience. Did they talk much about what happened back in their homes and where they were temporarily lodged?
I expected that we'd hear more of the stories. We did talk to people who had gone through the horrors of the Superdome and everything. But I think that it had been just long enough so that the stories weren't so fresh. They had told their stories. They had established friendships with other people who might have been staying in the same hotel or something. And they're really moving on to, you know, how to set up house in a little hotel room. You know, one man we went in and met, and he was cooking a big pot of turkey necks. Well, so we ate some great Cajun turkey necks. And I just loved working with the people.
How large a community was it that they were living in? In Texarkana. What, I mean, is that like a town or is it more like a small city?
It's like a small city. I'd say, you know, it's about the size of Westchester, for instance, or Norristown.
Okay. Yeah. And across the street is Texas.
Mm-hmm.
Someone told me it was a border town.
Well, you know, they don't seem to, I mean, they go across the street. It's not as though it's just the way that it is for the people who live there, you know.
Well, I mean, you don't need passports in this country.
Nope.
But I guess when you do a reporting back to whoever sets up things, that somehow messes up this block from going into that block.
Oh, it's interesting. I mean, it was amazing. I didn't even have any idea that that was going to be such a travesty, you know, that we were in a different jurisdiction.
What did you see as the primary problems that they had there when you were there? Was it really how to actually stay someplace to be housed? Was housing the major problem?
I think one of the biggest issues was that it was a lot of the women who were there because their husbands were trying to go back down to Louisiana to be able to continue with their work, to be able to continue to, you know, support their families. The uncertainty that they had about whether they'd get a trailer, the regulations about the trailer having to pass inspection, there was just a whole lot of obstacles to being able to get a sense of a temporarily permanent situation. I mean, it's still the case if, you know, if it's uncertain as to which parts of New Orleans they're going to be able to rebuild, their futures are still uncertain. But a lot of people that I met in Texarkana, people in Texarkana were wonderful. And most of the evacuees that I talked to realized that they wanted to stay now where they were. Their kids were in school in many cases. And they realized that they wouldn't be going back to New Orleans.
You're listening to University Forum with my guest, Anne Todd, a member of the WRTI family. And we're discussing her activities during a one-month period helping the evacuees from Katrina. That must have been quite an impact on you, though, even though that this seemed to have been a group that was a little more cohesive than the chaos that would have been elsewhere. But to see some of the ways in which you would want to help and yet had some barriers set up even for the helping person. I think I know what you did.
What? One person at a time. One question at a time. If there was, in some cases, there were extended families who might live together. And then the question was, did they get one FEMA registration number or two FEMA registration numbers? In some cases, it was a person with medical needs who didn't have the money to be able to get prescriptions filled, and helping them network with some groups who had set up assistance in Texarkana. That people in Texarkana had created a fund, and someone just applied if they needed bedding, if they needed furniture or something, there was assistance for them.
Well, help me with this. If you're in a hurricane and you've lost everything, you don't have time to go back and pick up all your papers to show who you are or what you have. How could they have money even? I mean, what source would they have? How would they prove that? I mean, did they have to prove it? That they had funds?
No. It got to the point where they realized they didn't have identification. And they basically, what we did in many cases was write down a statement. You know, I say that I am John Doe. I lived at 123 Lafayette Street in New Orleans in the parish of Orleans. And their declaration in front of us was sufficient. Obviously, they knew that there could be follow-up if they misrepresented themselves. And there was, you know, I understand there were some cases of that, but my experience was that the people were honest and didn't expect any more than, you know, than they might be entitled to, and didn't even realize what they could get in many cases. So that was our job.
Because if they don't have insurance cards with them, or if they're older people, if they're on Medicare, how did that get reconciled? It's a big job to look from the bureaucratic standpoint. It's very difficult to get all these little boxes right. Yeah, it's part of that they've got to do. But it's just difficult to know how, in the meantime, you put somebody out while this is being resolved.
Well, a lot of the hotel owners said, we won't do that.
Oh, good. You know,
so they took the responsibility to keep the people there.
Mm-hmm.
And then they kept extending the deadline.
And some of them, you say, felt that they probably wouldn't return home.
A lot of them realized that they liked, I mean, the people in Texarkana that I met, the people in the school district, Sherry Brown, who worked in the school district, they had set up meals back when the evacuees first arrived. So there was a lot of person-to-person, church-to-church.
They'd got settled
support.
In linkages there.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you were in the Peace Corps, and this was very different in some ways, but tell us a little bit about the Peace Corps and why you went into that. You were there for, what, 2 years?
Yeah, 2 years is a normal Peace Corps stint. Mm-hmm. I went in 1968 when I was out of college, 68 to 70. I applied. It said on the application, where would you like to go? And I left it empty. I mean, how was I going to decide? You know, send me wherever you need me.
And where you can take some pictures, too.
Well, whatever they needed me to do, and I took my cameras, and I have a lot of great photographs. But I got my long time processing. FBI comes and interviews you, and the application process takes a while. But when I got the invitation, it says you've been invited to serve in the Peace Corps in Togo. I started looking at the map in the South Pacific. I didn't know where Togo was. It was about a day before somebody said, well, look in Africa, you know, and there it was, this little sliver of a country right next to Ghana. So we trained, and we had this incredible Foreign Service Institute classes in French, because Togo is part of French-speaking West Africa. Became fluent in French and learned how to teach health education in French, and went off to work with midwife in a village.
Now, your background, though, didn't involve midwifery and health at all, did it?
Yeah, it was pretty arrogant on our part in the United States. But, you know, the great thing about the Peace Corps is it's kind of a secret. It really is an opportunity for people to work with people, to live where they live, to eat the foods they eat. And so the privilege really is for the Peace Corps volunteer to be embraced in a small community, to be immersed in their culture, and to realize just how different, but how much the same we are all over the world.
What did you find in Togo that you had the opportunity to, because, as you know, I said, I've been to Togo, but many years afterwards. In 68 to 70, what was Togo like?
Dusty little village. The chief of the village was a character. Polygamous society, so that, you know, I'd meet different wives of the chief at different times. When I started working in the dispensary, the first assignment we really had was to have the personnel in the dispensary start talking about prevention with the people they were treating. So every day I'd prepare a lesson, and the people who were waiting to be seen by the male nurse would be there for 10 minutes. We'd have maybe a 10-minute lesson on wound care or measles. I remember one time the first class I gave on atikase, which is the Ewe word for malaria or paludism in French. I asked the people, and this is being translated into the local language, which I wasn't fluent in, where malaria came from. How did they get malaria? And they thought it came from the sun because of the fevers. So then no one had ever taught them the connection between mosquitoes and malaria, because it just wasn't part of the culture that they were taught prevention before we got there. I started building a latrine because there weren't facilities in the village. Seems like that's kind of the joke. Peace Corps people go in and build latrines. And then something else that I did was there were a newborn baby, two cases at least in the first 6 months that I was there. A newborn baby would be brought in by its mother, and it was in paroxysms of tetanus, it turned out. I didn't know what it was, you know, but it turns out that the midwife explained to me that when they cut the umbilical cord with a broken bottle, because they don't have scissors or razors, then the tetanus spores infect the umbilical cord and the baby got tetanus. And I was just so struck by the fact that this was preventable. So the first thing that the midwife and I did was to give the women bottles with alcohol and razors and string and ask them to cut the cord with that. But then we were still only reaching a few women. So I asked the Peace Corps doctor, if we gave the pregnant women tetanus shots, would that protect the unborn child? And he said, I don't know. I said, well, will it hurt the child? And he said, no, it wouldn't hurt the child. So I went back to the village and I said to Marie, the midwife, and the doctor there, okay, every pregnant woman that comes in, we're going to give a tetanus shot to, in the hopes that maybe. So I left after 2 years, and 20 years later, I went back to visit. And I was curious as to whether they were using the latrine that we built. And the latrine was all overgrown with weeds and everything. But before I even saw the latrine, I was in a bus to go out to the village. And there was a big billboard that said, vaccinez-vous contre le tétanos, protégez votre enfant. Vaccinate, get a vaccination, get a tetanus shot if you're pregnant to protect your child. Organisation Mondiale de la Santé, the World Health Organization. And it turned out that in that period of time, it was determined that tetanus shots would protect unborn babies. And we had started doing it in the village before it became common practice.
How did you feel about that? My goodness.
I think it, other than my pride in this, my son, you know, who's 22-year-old Penn student, I think it's the most moving thing that I've ever experienced contributing.
Well, it's just wonderful that FEMA had the opportunity to have your services in Arkansas.
Thank you.
Yeah, because there are not many people who would have had that kind of interest and background, because I'm sure part of what you were doing in Arkansas also was making sure there was connection to health facilities and school and all the rest of that.
Yes.
Would you do this again? Would you continue to do this kind of volunteerism?
Oh, at a certain point, I was so inspired after I signed up, I thought, well, maybe I could just, you know, become a Crisis Corps volunteer and be sent wherever they're needed, you know, wherever we're needed, Pakistan, you know. Mm-hmm. And then I thought, well, that's not necessarily something I'm going to do right now with my family still in town.
As I say, the Nonviolent Peace Force group is very active in Sri Lanka and other places around the world.
Well, in fact, December of 2004, I saw an email about the Rotary doing a final polio vaccination campaign in West Africa. And I did go for 2 weeks, 2 years ago, to West Africa to assist with this polio immunization campaign that Rotary was doing.
Are you a Rotarian yet?
No.
Well, you ought to join us.
Yeah? Okay.
Yes, because I did read that part about the different groups that you make and how you were invited to something, and it's a wonderful thing. Mm. And polio, of course, is an area that Rotary takes great pride in trying to eradicate polio.
Very, very close to having it accomplished.
Well, I hope you got some satisfaction over what you did in Arkansas.
Oh, it was a privilege.
Would you do it again? I'm asking you again. Would you go back again?
Well, I fortunately wouldn't have to do that again, but I'd definitely respond to a Crisis Corps appeal.
They still have great need down in New Orleans and in Gaucher and some other places. I just think it's wonderful that they had this opportunity for you to be there. And I appreciate so much your being my guest on University Forum and sharing this information with me, because you have quite a background both in your graphic work, your teaching, all the different things that you have done. You've worked with disabled people in the past and continue to show that feeling of helping that's so much needed by people in today's world, because that's part of our problem. We don't have enough of that genuine love and connection.
Thanks. I want to thank all the people who contribute to WRTI, too, because the music that we play is kind of a spiritual or like a soul healing possibility that's provided by the station. So thank you for those of you, to those of you who I know through your membership at the station.
Well, you're a photographer, wide experience, and what you've done in terms of your work, your outstanding work at WRTI, your classroom work. You're a swim coach too, I understand. So.
Oh, I was at one point in my life, yeah.
You've done all these many different things. And I tell you, I've seen some of the pictures that you've brought back and some of the articles, and I think people loved you there because you were so genuine in terms of your connection with them.
Thank you.
And you weren't going to take no for an answer when it was necessary to say yes.
Can I mention that there's a show, there's a photography show?
When is the show?
The show is now hanging in the High Wire Gallery, which is at 1315 Cherry Street in the Gilbert Building, and 8 of us photographers have our work there, and my photographs of Africa are also included in that show.
Well, they mustn't miss that. They really must get to see that. And I thank you so much for being my guest on University Forum.
Thank you, Jean.
Please send your comments or questions on University Forum programs to me by email, jemoore@temple.edu, or call my voicemail, 215-204-4372.